I see we have lots of project milestones in our inbox, so that's good. Everybody's been hard at work. What I'd like to start out with is just say a few words about the solution to assignment three, which has been handed out, and which I hope you worked on a little bit in addition to getting the projects in shape. There were two problems in assignment three. The first one was to look at some histories. So these are actual sequences of operations that executed, and to determine what level of two-phase locking, if at all, is being used. So this is just another example of teaching you how to reason about these histories and start thinking in terms of executions, which, as I keep repeating, is very important in this area if you're going to understand the behavior of transactions. You've got to be able to reason about histories. So I'm just going to say a few words about each of them. It's not something that can be easily gone over, I don't think. So I just want to point out a couple of points, and then if you have questions, I can answer them. And then if you want to look at it in between sentences while I'm lecturing, we can go over it again after a break. So in the first problem, the goal basically is to sprinkle lock and unlock operations throughout the history in a way that makes each transaction as strongly two-phase locked as possible, essentially. And if it's not two-phase, if it is two-phase locked, then of course it will be serializable. But if it's not two-phase locked, then you have to still determine whether the result is serializable. It might be, it might not be. So the first two sort of warm-ups. So I invented this new term for the purpose of this assignment of being very strict two-phase locked, which means that you're holding read locks till after commit. Just to add an interesting variation. Actually, it's often done because the not every system, systems can release read locks the moment the commit shows up, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they hold them until afterwards. So in first history, all the transactions are very strict two-phase locked, and the solution shows you where you can put the lock operations to make this true. I commented about lock escalation and the lock conversion last time, so about read locks and write locks, and if a transaction has a write lock on a piece of data, it does not also need to obtain a read lock, and that actually came up, that issue came up in the first history with read one of Y, which in this case it had a second example of read one of Y. It already set the lock once before. In history two, the second transaction, T2, is not strict two-phase locked because of this little phrase that's shown where it's transaction 2's transaction 2's write lock on Z must have been released before transaction 2 committed, because in between W2 of Z and commit 2, there's an operation W1 of Z. W1 of Z to execute must have obtained a write lock. The only way it could have obtained the write lock is if transaction 2 released that write lock, which clearly would be before it committed. So this is not even strict two-phase lock. But it is two-phase locked. It's not. There are no locking violations. History 3 is not even serializable, so it's clearly not any kind of two-phase locked. And it shows in the solution two of the serialization graph edges that demonstrate a cycle in the serialization graph. It shows that it's not serializable. Let's see, history 4. History 4 is strict two-phase locked, but not very strict, because T1 has to release its read lock on X, which is shown sort of toward the end of the first line in the history. It has to release its read lock on X before it commits in order to allow transaction 2 to write X, which appears also before transaction 1 commits. So it's releasing a read lock early before the transaction commits. But it is holding its write locks till after commit. Notice this is not an execution. The algorithm that produces strict two-phase locking, which holds all read locks right up to commit, could not have produced this history. Or probably, I should say, did not produce this history, because you would have expected transaction. No, it's easy. Could not or might not. No, could not, because transaction. Okay, so transaction one writes Z immediately before commit one. So clearly, transaction one is releasing its read lock on X before its commit was submitted. So the algorithm for doing strict two-phase locking, where a transaction doesn't release any locks until the commit operation is submitted, could not have produced this execution. This is where I think some people get confused. There's the algorithm for producing strict two-phase locking, which we're going to see again in problem two. And then there's the property of strict two-phase locking. And they're a little different. The algorithm for strict two-phase locking will always produce an execution that's strict two-phase locked. But there are histories that are strict two-phase locked, which could not have been produced by that algorithm. And this, in fact, is an example. This execution is strict two-phase locked. Each transaction is holding its write locks till after it commits. But transaction one, in this case, is releasing its read lock earlier than it would in that other execution, in an execution produced by the strict two-phase locking algorithm. And so this history could not have been produced by that algorithm. Right, this is a fairly important point, and it starts to get at why it's so important to reason about histories, because if you just look at these algorithms, you don't really see exactly what the interleavings are that are actually taking place, that are actually possible. It looks like there's a typo in the solution, actually. It says for history 5, and then the next line talks about history 6, which is clearly not what's intended. Now I'm confused. No, it's history 5. I don't know where that came from. It's repeated. The error is repeated. All the H6s are supposed to be H5s. Both of them. In any case, what's shown here in the solution is I made an attempt to add lock operations and eventually just painted myself into a corner, where I was being forced to add lock operations in a certain way, and at the very end, I needed to set one more lock operation, but in order to set it, I needed to release a lock, which was just not possible to release at this point because the transaction had not issued all of its operations, and therefore the result would be non-two-phase locked, so you just get stuck. But the interesting thing is the execution is still serializable. I gave you an example of that in lecture last time or the time before, I forget now, but I showed you another simple example where that takes place, where there are serializable executions that cannot be produced by two-phase locking. This is another such example. Okay. So that's it for the first question. The second question, I had a number of people send me email about this for clarification. The second question is talking, this is not the history. It's not giving you the history in which operations execute. It's giving you the sequence in which the operations arrive coming into the data manager. And, you know, if operations were never delayed or rejected, then the order in which they're issued would be the order in which they execute. But in this case, that's not true. And in fact, it's pretty obvious it's not true from the get-go. If you look at the sequence A, where it gives transaction 1 reads X and Y, that's fine, sets read locks. Transaction 2 reads X, that's fine, sets a read lock. And now transaction 1 tries to write X. Obviously, that can't happen now, because transaction 2 has already obtained a read lock on X, and so the write operation on X must be delayed. So it's the order in which the operations arrive, but it's not the order in which they execute. And so what I show here in the solution is the order in which they execute, including in brackets where certain operations are getting blocked and then where they're getting released by virtue of a lock being released, and therefore the operation can now run. All right, so there's the order. In other words, I'm trying to emphasize the distinction here between the order in which the operations arrive, the order in which they execute. It's even possible, I didn't come up with an example. Well, I could have come up with an operation sequence that's not even feasible. For example, in B, the execution deadlocks in the end. The very last operation in the sequence deadlocks. So if I had added another operation from one of the deadlocked transactions, or for both of the deadlocked transactions, that would have been impossible. I could have added it for one of the deadlocked transactions, provided that it was the other one that aborted as a consequence of the deadlock. But I actually could have set it up so that sequence of operations was just infeasible. So the reason why I asked about where the commits go is that the idea is that you want the transaction to commit as early as possible, because that's going to enable it to release its locks and thereby free up the blocked operations. That's why I said that in each of these cases, assume that the commit happens as early as it's feasible to happen. I didn't actually show you. If I'd shown you where they came, that would have been a very strong hint as to where the unlocks could actually occur. Okay? So that's going to be it for assignments that reason about these histories. But if you're at all fuzzy about it, let me know, because it's easy to ask exam questions on something like this. You know, come up with more histories very, very, very easily compared to other things that I might ask. It's not a guarantee, but so I guess the next. Are there any questions on the assignment? I guess you can probably have to read the solution a bit first. But anything? What about the project? Are there any questions about the project? Probably are all questioned out given the amount of email I've been answering for the last few days. I'm sorry, I was a little slow the last couple of days. I was traveling. But I think I've answered everybody. If you have an outstanding question that by email about the project that I haven't answered, you know, probably worth pinging me, because you might have gotten lost in the mountain of email. Nothing? Great. Okay. Well, let's get back to database recovery then. This topic is, I don't normally do this, but this topic is complicated enough and builds on itself enough that I think it's worthwhile spending 5 or 10 minutes just kind of recapping the sequence that I get us back into the place, get us back up to the state of knowledge where I stopped last time, because we're going to just pick up from that point and go even deeper. So I'm going to start fairly early on progress here. There we go. I'm not pressing hard enough. Okay, so remember, the storage model is that we have a stable database, which is probably a disk. We've got volatile memory, a cache, and then we have a cache manager that's moving data in between the two. Right? That we're assuming that the stable storage has read and write operations, which are all or nothing, and that errors are detected, all faults are detected, which we already understand is quite a big leap of abstraction, but that's what we're going to assume for the rest of the recovery discussion. And the cache manager, its main job is to move data between stable storage and the cache. So a fetch operation takes a page out of stable storage, puts it in the cache. The flush operation takes a page out of cache, writes it into stable storage. And then there are some other operations here too, pin, unpin, and deallocate. So we got stable storage, the cache. The cache has descriptors describing each slot in the cache, which includes the page, the identity of the page, the stable storage address of the page. A dirty bit to indicate whether the page has been updated since the last time it was flushed. The cache address of the page, of course, and a pin count, which is the number of programs that have pinned the page down and have not yet unpinned it. So, if you will, it's the number of pin operations that have executed on that page minus the number of unpin operations. The fetch and flush I've already described. The pin operation simply sets the bit which makes the page non-flushable and non-replaceable. So if it's clean, then it's just non-replaceable, since you would never flush a clean page. And if it's dirty, then it also makes it non-flushable. Unpin releases it. So you typically pin the page for as long as you're reading or writing the page, typically for a while, because you're actively working access methods going in and out of the page. Deallocate does the obvious thing, releases the page from cache. And all of this is happening down here at the page level file system. Everything above, all the database operations are happening above, manipulating records, reading and writing records, which are laid out on the page. And we're going to be, last time we ignored records for the most part, but tonight we're going to get into the assumption that the pages are actually carved up into records. A latch is basically a lock operation that gives its owner exclusive access to the page. And so typically you set a pin for a moderately long period. You set a latch only while you're actually in the page and modifying the bytes. But you know, if you're going to be going in and out of the, if you've got a program that's going to be, for example, reading or writing a bunch of different records on the page, with some computation in between, then it might pin the page, it'll latch the page, do something to a record, unlatch the page, come back again, latch the page, do something to another record, unlatch the page, and then unpin at the end when it's all done with the page. There's no deadlock detection for latches, so if the next layer of software wants to latch two pages, it better be extremely careful, because obviously, all you need is two threads latching two pages in the opposite order, and they deadlock. There's no deadlock detection for this. So the usual rule of thumb is you never latch more than one page at a time. Otherwise, you've got to have some knowledge of exactly the sequence in which the latches will always take place to make sure that they'll never deadlock. All right, we've got a log. The log has log records, most of which are update records containing the before and after image of an update, plus the identifier of the transaction that performed the update, plus commit records and abort records. And the assumption, which is enforced by the update protocol, is that the order of updates that appear in the log is equal to the order in which updates were applied to the pages. So for, it's really only important for each page. For each page, the sequence of updates applied to that page is exactly the sequence of its corresponding update records in the log. And that was already important at this level. It's going to become even more important, if that's possible, when I get into additional detail here tonight. So the sequence of operations then is you fetch a page. This is an access method layer. We'll fetch a page, pin a page, then read lock or write lock the page, write latch the page if it's writing into it, update it, log the update, unlatch the page, and then unpin it. Although in between that pin and unpin, there may be multiple latch-unlatch sequences. Okay. Then there's the recovery manager.
Where was the unlock in that previous page?
There is no unlock here.
Okay.
Why?
You can't do it until you commit.
Right. You're not going to see the unlock till you commit, and there's no. All you're seeing here is a single update to the page. Transaction might update many pages before any of the locks are released. Normally, the lock operation will be, well, if locking is done at a fixed granularity like page level, then it will typically write lock the page every time because the application level code that's accessing the page doesn't realize it has a write lock. It'll just go in and it'll. The lock manager will tell it that it has the lock, but it will actually attempt to set it again. If we're locking at multiple granularities, then that's not true. Then higher level software might know that the lock is held, in which case you won't always see a lock operation in this sequence because higher level software has already obtained a lock that covers the page being updated. All right, so. Commit operation, abort operation, we know what they're supposed to do. Install the updates or undo all the updates, which leads us to this picture here, just an extension of the previous picture where the transactions are issuing these commit and abort operations. Restart is what the cache manager, what the recovery manager is asked to do after it has recovered from a failure. Either the data manager has failed and recovered or the operating system has failed and recovered, which implies the database system data manager has failed and recovered. So to implement abort, we have to make sure that if the after image of any page updated by the transaction was written to the stable database, we need to be sure that the undo information, the before image, was first written to the log. All right, and that's the undo rule. Before you put an after image of an uncommitted update in the database, make sure that the before image of that update is in the log already. Not just that you sent it to the log, but you actually wrote it to the log and got an acknowledgement from the disk that log record is out there on disk. Then it's okay to issue the update to the stable database. That's the write-ahead log protocol. You can avoid this issue simply by never writing uncommitted data to the stable database. So a recovery algorithm requires undo only if it's permitted to send an uncommitted update to the stable database. The commit operation has to write all of the transactions after images to stable storage before the transaction commits, because once it commits, it's making a durability guarantee. Therefore, all the updates must be durable. If not in the stable database, then at least in the log. All right, so that's the redo rule. So we have the undo rule and then the redo rule. The redo rule is don't commit a transaction until the after images are in the are in stable storage. And there is some tension here because the undo rule says don't write after images into the stable database. Avoiding undo says don't write after images into the stable database until after the transaction commits. And the redo rule says write all of the transactions updates to stable storage before the transaction commits. So they're obviously at loggerheads. We're actually going to allow both. So, but you know how to avoid them, both of them, because most of you have implemented this already. And then there's restart. Restart is the operation that's going to get the database back into shape after a failure to make sure that includes all committed updates and no aborted updates or no updates performed by an uncommitted transaction. And restart has to be idempotent. That is, if restart fails and then the system comes back up again, restart must still be able to run. So you've got to make sure you never do anything during restart that prevents restart from running again. And we'll be talking about idempotence off and on in a variety of contexts, not just in the context of restart. So most practical algorithms for doing high-speed transaction processing use logs. The log is a sequential file. It contains the records that I've already talked about, update records, commit abort records, and abort records. The way a commit happens is simply by writing a commit record to the end of the log. The commit could not have been requested until the transaction terminated. Therefore, all of the transaction's update records already are in the log. So it's safe to put the commit record at the end of the log. And then you flush the log, thereby guaranteeing that all the updates are on disk, at least in the log, if not in the stable database, thereby satisfying the redo rule. To abort a transaction, you scan the log going backwards and pick up the before images of all the updates performed by the transaction and write them back into the cache. Or if necessary, read the page off of disk. If the page is no longer in cache, then you have to fetch it from stable database back into cache in order to undo the update, restore the before image. And then restart works by scanning the log and redoing updates of all committed transactions, undoing updates of all aborted and active transactions, that is, transactions that neither committed nor aborted before the last failure. We're implementing commit. Typically, we use group commit, which means that when a transaction commits, we add the commit record to the end of the log, but we do not immediately flush the last log page. Instead, we wait some short time, like a few milliseconds, 5 milliseconds, so that we know that give that page a chance to fill up before we ship it out to disk, so we get the full benefit of the log bandwidth writing the log to disk. To implement abort, we chain all of the update records for each transaction back through the log. So every time you add an update record to the log, you add a back pointer to the previous update record for the same transaction. And then in memory, you have a set of transaction descriptors, each of which points to the last log record of that transaction. Not the first one, but the last one. So you just keep adding to the end of the list. That way, if a transaction aborts, you just look in the descriptor, you pick up the last log record, and now you can just hop from log record to log record, performing undos, restoring the before images until you get back to the beginning. Usually, a fairly large portion of the tail of the log remains in memory. Now, most of that tail is actually on disk. It's already been flushed. But you want it in memory because of these aborts. You don't want to have to go back to the disk in order to get log records and perform aborts. That's going to disrupt the this high-performance system where you're trying to push updates out to the log as quickly as possible. So you're going to dedicate a sizable chunk of memory to that last part of the log so that you don't have to keep reading things back in off the log. At recovery time, you will, of course, have to read things off the stable log. But during normal operation, it's better if you can just do it all in main memory. We satisfy the undo rule by adding another column to the cache descriptor called the log sequence number. And the log sequence number is a logical pointer to the last update record that updated the page corresponding to that cache slot descriptor. So for each cache slot, if it's dirty, there is some log record which represents the very last update that's been performed on that dirty page. All right? That's what the descriptor is pointing to. It's that log record that's the very last update to that dirty page. And the reason why we want that is if we ever want to flush the page that's in that cache slot, we need to know that the before images of all the earlier updates to that page are already on the disk. And the way we do it is we just look in the cache slot, look up that log sequence number, and check to see whether the log has been flushed up through that point. If it has, then we know that all of the before images are out in stable storage, and therefore it's perfectly safe to write the after image of that page to the stable database, even though the transaction that wrote that page last may not have committed. Almost always, this is just a simple pointer check, because under normal operation, the system is pushing these log pages out very often, and you don't normally flush a page unless it hasn't been accessed recently. Therefore, almost for sure, that last log record is out on disk, and so it's very rare that when you flush a page to the stable database, you actually have to do something to flush the log. It's almost always out there by now. Now comes restart. This is what we were doing when we ended last time, was going through restart, and then we're going to continue from this point. So, so my initial restart algorithm was to scan the log backwards, starting from the end, assuming you can find the end. Talked about that for a while. But assuming you can find the end of the log, you scan backwards, and you construct a list of all the committed transactions and all of the recovered pages. So if you hit a commit record, as you're scanning backwards, you add it to the commit list. If you hit an update record, you look to see whether the page has been updated and has already been restored, whether it's already on this recovered page list. If it has not yet been restored, then you look at the transaction ID of the update. And if the transaction ID is on the list of committed transactions, remember, you're scanning backwards. So if the update committed, you'll have already seen the commit record, and therefore it will be on your commit list. So if the transaction committed, then you install its after image in the database. And if it has not committed, then it must have aborted. And so you install its before image in the database. Right. Now, if the page is already, this is actually a modification to this. I didn't fix the slide yet, but somebody asked the question last time. If the page has been recovered, you might still have to restore the before image. If the second update that you see is for the same transaction as the first update. In other words, if a transaction wrote into a page twice, you're going to have two update records. And the before image of the second update record is going to be equal to the after image of the first update record. And so you really want to also install the before image of the second update record you run into. So on this recovered page list, you not only need the page ID, but also the transaction ID of the transaction whose before image is the one that you actually installed. As soon as you see a new transaction ID, you're done, because once a page has been recovered, the last transaction that updated that page, once it has been recovered, you know for sure the page has the last committed value. Right? Because there's only two possibilities. The transaction committed, in which case its update is the last committed value, or the transaction aborted. But if it aborted, then it's the before image of that page is whatever was in the database at the time it ran, which, of course, must have been the last committed update. It may not have been the very most recent transaction in the log that updated that page, because that one may have aborted too, but it doesn't matter. The page that it read must have had the last committed update. So you only need to worry about the recovered page list for the last transaction to have updated the page. Even if it updated multiple times, you're going to have to look at it. But other than that, you're in good shape. Now, the problem with this procedure, you may recall, was there was no stopping condition. Because how far back do you have to go redoing and undoing updates? So what you need to do is periodically checkpoint the log against the database to put a boundary as to how much of the log has to be scanned at recovery time. And we looked at two checkpointing algorithms. The first one was we stopped the action, we completed all active transactions, we waited till all active operations finished. We waited till all reads and all reads, writes, commits, aborts that were in flight have finished. We don't process any new ones that arrive. Excuse me. We don't process any new ones that arrive. And then we flush the entire dirty cache. Every dirty page in cache, we just push it out to disk. When that's all done, we mark the end of the log with a list of all the transactions that are active at that point, along with, just for convenience, a pointer to the last log record for each of those active transactions. All right? Now, the reason why this is helpful is that it says that we do not have to redo any transaction that precedes that point in the log at recovery time. So when we do the procedure in the last slide, we scan the log going backwards, and when we hit the last checkpoint record, we know the only thing left to do is to undo the operations of any transaction that was active at the last checkpoint record and did not subsequently commit or abort. Because if it's subsequently committed or aborted, then all of the updates have been restored, but if it was active. Did I say that right? I think I just said something that's wrong. Let's see. If a transaction was in the last checkpoint record, active, and it's subsequently aborted, we still have to continue the abort. We can't just stop. We have to continue. So for any transaction that was active at the last checkpoint record and did not subsequently commit, we have to go back and continue the process. We may not have to do anything because the pages that it updated may have been subsequently restored. They may be on that list of restored pages, but we still have to undo them.
So we have to go all the way to the previous checkpoint?
No.
And see that these guys aren't there?
No, because you just complete the transaction. I mean, you just hop around on the. You're going back through
the linked list.
Yeah. So The question was whether we have to worry about the second to last checkpoint here.
Okay, the linked list will end.
The linked list for each transaction will end.
Right, I was worrying about how we would find the first update.
Right, okay. You just go back in each transaction until you hit a null back pointer, and then you know you're done with that transaction.
Question about what you just said. So when you said a transaction and the checkpoint subsequently aborted, are you saying that it wrote an abort record to the log, or that we need to abort it because we didn't see...
When I said that a transaction that was active at the last checkpoint subsequently aborted, it's either because there's an abort record in the log or because there's no commit record or abort record. In either case, we've got this situation where the transaction aborted. So let's take a simple example. Suppose that one of those transactions wrote into page 0, all right, which is one of the pages in the database, and it's the only transaction in the entire log that wrote into page 0. There's nothing later in the log that you will find any updates on page 0. Right? Now, given that we flushed all of the pages at the last checkpoint, that means we flushed that update to page 0 of this transaction. And it's sitting in the database, and it's wrong, because the transaction subsequently aborted. And so, even though it came earlier than the last checkpoint, even if there was an abort record for it in the log...
So when you say flush at a checkpoint, you're flushing even if the transaction hasn't committed, or everything's being flushed?
Any dirty page in the cache is being flushed. Now, we don't know. I mean, we might be doing redundant work, because it could be, you know, the transaction wrote into page 0, the system took a checkpoint, its update got flushed out into the database. A little bit later, it aborted. All right. The system ran an abort operation in main memory. During that time, I mean, there's an abort record in the log, so the system did, in fact, install the before image of page 0. The problem is we don't know whether it ever left the cache and went back to the database, because we don't have any more checkpoint records. We have no record of all the updates that happened later in the log. We don't know which ones went out to the stable database and which ones didn't. And so we have to assume the worst and therefore continue going back to install all of them, all of those before images. Okay? Now, I can actually... So, let me do this again. With the same checkpointing procedure, we can now do it the other way. We can start at the last checkpoint record and move forward instead of going backward. All right? We start at the last checkpoint record. We go forward in the log. We redo all updates, and we process all aborts. So, in other words, we might end up performing the updates of a transaction which later in the log gets aborted, but there's no harm done. Right? We just start out with a set of transaction descriptors, which is exactly the list of transaction descriptors in the last checkpoint record, ones that were active. Each of them has a pointer to its last log record, and we just start cranking. We just start running. If we see an update record for a new transaction, we just add it to the list of transaction descriptors. If we see a commit, we just wipe it out of the list of transaction descriptors. If we see an abort, we undo all of its updates, and then we wipe it out from the list of transaction descriptors. When we get to the end, there will still be some active transactions, that is to say, transaction descriptors for transactions where we saw neither a commit nor an abort record. And so when we're all done, we'll abort the ones that are left in the same way as before, just ripple back and just undo all of their updates. And now for them, it's an optimization. We could figure out, keep track of what pages were already restored, but we really don't need to. We can just undo all of their updates because with page level locking, they must have been the last ones to update any of the pages that they updated, because after all, they were still active at the time of the failure. We're using two-phase locking. They're holding write locks till after commit. So they did perform the last update to any page for which there's an update record for any of those transactions. Okay. And you know, as I closed with last time, the big problem with this is actually pretty good. This is, the bookkeeping is pretty clever, and it looks like it's all going to work. But it's not fast enough, because that checkpointing operation takes too long. It's like it's like garbage collection. You just have to stop everything for a while and sweep the cache clean. You know, and the disk can only do, each disk is only doing 100 to 150 write operations per second randomly, and that's just not good enough if you've got a big cache. So what you want to do is you want to be able to checkpoint continuously and still get the same effect as the previous algorithm. All right, and this is where I end. This is the last slide I covered last time, which is fuzzy checkpointing. And so the way it's almost the same as the last algorithm, which is that you stop the action, you stop accepting new operations, you make a list of all the dirty pages in cache, which is just like what you did the last time, except that the last time you actually flushed all those pages. This time we're not going to flush them right away. We're just going to make a list of all of the dirty pages in cache. We're going to set that list aside, okay? And then we're going to make a list of all the active transactions as we did before, and we're going to append a checkpoint record as we did before to the log that includes all the active transactions with a pointer to their last log record. Then we resume normal operation, and in parallel with doing normal operation, we take that list of dirty pages that we set aside, and we start doing the writes as fast as we can without interfering with any active transactions, particularly the read operations of active transactions, because the read operations of active transactions, after all, is reducing the response time, or it's lengthening the response time. It's reducing the performance of any active transaction, because when a transaction is running and it does a read, it gets delayed until you go to disk and fetch the relevant page if needed. So you really want those reads to be very high priority so that you're running transactions as fast as possible. Writes are not such a big deal, because you're going to update the cache and write a log record, and it will get out to disk in its own good time. But the log is the fastest thing in the whole system, because it's just this sequential, fire hose of data going out to the disk. Right? So sort of whenever you can, in between the reads that are being done for active transactions, you start flushing those pages on that list of dirty pages that you collected. And when you've swept the cache clean, when that entire list is exhausted, you run another checkpoint. And that new checkpoint is done with exactly the same algorithm as I just described. You stop the action, you get a list of all the dirty pages, you get a list of all the active transactions, you write a log record, you flush the checkpoint record, and you start flushing the cache in the background while you're processing normal transactions. So in this situation, the time it takes to perform a checkpoint is not that great. Now, it's not quite as cheap as you might imagine, because you're probably looking at a multi-gigabyte memory, so you can kind of work out how many pages. If it's an 8-gigabyte memory, there's a million pages to go through and look at the 30-bit, and they're scattered all over, so you're going to get pretty crappy CPU performance running around looking at all these bits to figure out what's going on, and it's spread out in this cache table, but it's still not zero time. It's measured in milliseconds, but it's not nanoseconds. But it's reasonably fast. And then you write the log record. So now there's no I/O that's slowing down checkpointing. That's the important thing. So it's a very minor performance hiccup. In fact, if you've got a transaction load that's not doing too many updates, it may turn out that you're actually flushing too frequently. You might be running checkpoints even more often than you want. So you probably want to have a minimal real-time checkpoint interval, that you don't ever checkpoint in more often than every 15 seconds or something, because there's just no point. You just end up thrashing, just using the system to checkpoint all the time. All right, so now the algorithm for recovery is exactly the same as before. The only difference is that you start with the second-to-last checkpoint record instead of the last checkpoint record. Because the second, all the updates that precede the second-to-last or penultimate checkpoint record are definitely in the stable database. That's what it meant. That's why you wrote the last checkpoint record. The last checkpoint record says, that's what it says, that all the updates that precede the previous checkpoint record are in the stable database. Right? Because that second-to-last checkpoint record, when you wrote it, you made a list of all of the dirty pages, you started flushing, and it was only after you completed flushing that you wrote the last checkpoint record. So the last checkpoint record says that all the updates that precede the penultimate checkpoint record are in the stable database. So it's from then on, it's the same algorithm. Now, the only thing that's a little strange is the last checkpoint record is useless. You know, you might think that the last checkpoint record is telling you something that somehow is going to help recovery, but it actually doesn't. The only thing it does is it tells you that the previous checkpoint record is the one that you really care about. But it will become relevant because there will be another checkpoint record after that one. And that one will make the next one, the previous one, relevant as the penultimate checkpoint record. And this will just keep going on and on over time, right? Great. Yes. Question.
So what guarantees that low priority flush of all dirty pages will ever complete? Seems like you'd have a hot page and maybe it's pinned by a lot of different things at once, and maybe the pin count never goes down to zero and never actually gets flushed.
Okay, so the question is, how do you make sure that you actually flush all the pages? There's a couple things that might happen wrong. One is that the transaction load may be too high, and the reads are just completely dominating the disk, and there's just not enough bandwidth to get the writes out fast enough. So you may well want to do some load control to make sure that the list of dirty pages is indeed being flushed fast enough, and do some load control at the front end. Sort of not if the writes are not happening fast enough, you reduce the number of threads that are dedicated to active transactions, and you keep cutting it down until you have a small enough number of parallel active transactions that there's enough disk bandwidth to be able to do the writes at whatever you regard as the minimal acceptable rate. Right? The other question you asked is, what about a given page? Suppose I have a page that's very popular, it's hot, it's being updated over and over and over and over. Every time the checkpointer, the flusher, that's sweeping the cache, every time it tries to flush that page, the darn thing is locked, it's latched. It just has to go into a test and set loop in order to force it. And I don't know if anybody actually does it, whether it's actually a practical consideration or not, but clearly you could occasionally make it golden, where you have a bit. In addition to a latch bit, you have a golden bit, which you allow one client to identify that, saying this page is not eligible for latching, and so because there's some very high priority task, in this case the cache sweeper, that has to get in, and once it sets that bit, whoever's got that latched, when they unlatch it, it's going to stay unlatched until the golden process gets in. The problem with that is you have to be very careful with queuing, because you're going to be, as you point out, I mean, this is only relevant if the page is extremely hot. If it's extremely hot, you've got lots of transactions that want to update or read the page. If that's the case, and you've got this sweeper that wants to get into that page, you better be darn sure that when that latch is released, very shortly thereafter, the sweeper gets in there to actually clean the page, because there's a lot of, you're creating this backlog of transactions that want to update the page. Okay? Let's do something new. Took quite a long time to review that, but it's worth going through more than once. All right, so I told you from the beginning that this page level locking, page level logging was totally impractical for modern systems. They're just too fast. You would end up logging too much and locking too much. There would be too much lock contention. There would be the log would be too long. You have to be able to lock records. So the image you should have now is that each page actually has multiple records on the page. Okay. And I don't know, I could explain the page layout. There's a standard way of doing slotted pages to be able to put records on pages. But for the current discussion, it's not really important. The important thing to know is that there are multiple records per page, and the records are being independently locked. In particular, you could have two active transactions which are locking two different records on the same page. Okay? So let's suppose that's the case. We have two records here, X and Y, and the X and Y here. And they're both on page P, and there's two transactions, and they've each updated the respective records. Now, transaction 1 aborts, and transaction 2 commits. So this is not strict with respect to pages, but it is strict with respect to records, and that's okay. We can still install before images, but we have to install the before images of the records. Now, there's a couple of things that happen now. One is that this idea of having, let's see, don't want to say this. If you were scanning the log backwards, knowing which pages have been recovered wouldn't help you, because you would have to redo everything. This is why you want to. Trying to invent a new explanation here on the fly, and it's not working. Let me go back to the one that I know works. So the recovery algorithm starts at the penultimate checkpoint and does redo till the end. With record level operations, this is very appealing because you don't have to keep track of which records have been updated and which ones haven't. You know, in the reverse log scan algorithm, remember, I had to keep track of which pages were already recovered. I didn't want to recover a page that's already been recovered because I might undo a committed update. Right? That was, you know, if you're scanning from the end back to the beginning, and I recover page 0, and I restore its committed value, and then I hit another transaction, which aborted. I restore its before image. I might be taking a committed value and undoing it because there was some later transaction that committed that already updated that page. Right? So the last transaction that committed updated page 0, and the second to last transaction, which aborted, also updated page 0. If I undo its updates, I'm gonna undo that last committed update. Bad idea. So that's why I had to keep track of doing a backward scan. That's why I had to keep track of the last committed the pages that have already been restored, so I didn't accidentally undo a committed update. But if I do it in the forward direction from the penultimate checkpoint to the end, I don't have to do that bookkeeping. I'm just going to blindly redo everything, and then on the backward scan, I'll fix up all of the aborts or all of the active transactions, and that will the only ones that I'm going to have to undo at the end are the ones that that were active at the time of failure. So there's no risk of undoing a committed update in that case. So it's a simpler algorithm if I start from the last checkpoint or the penultimate checkpoint and go to the end. But one of the bad things about this algorithm is that I have to read pages in order to undo the updates. See, when I was storing before images of entire pages in the log, the whole before or after image is right there in the log. right? It doesn't either the before image of the page or the after image of the page. I just take it out of the log record and I plop it into cache. I don't need to go into the database and do a random access to the database in order to pull the page in order to undo or redo. It's right there for me in the log. But now I'm going to undo and redo record updates. So I have to actually have a copy of the page in cache in order to undo or redo that record to install its before image or after image. That requires reading the page out of the database. That's more I/O, right? Not a good thing, right? That's going to slow down recovery. So we're going to have to look at ways to fix that. The good news, though, is that the log has gotten smaller, because now instead of logging entire pages, we're only logging records. So the log has shrunk. That's good. Less log I/O in order to do restart. But the bad thing is we're going to have to read pages off the disk in order to undo and redo. That's going to increase the amount of I/O. Now we can further reduce the size of the log by not even storing the before and after image of the entire record. What we could have very fine-grained operations. We could have operations to read and write fields of records, for example. I mean, you could now. It doesn't just have to be one kind of update that's stored in the log. You can invent any kind of updates you want. You could have an insert operation, which includes the after image and no before image. You could have a delete operation, which deletes a record based on its ID and only contains the before image and no after image. Or you can say update field, and it includes the before image and after image, but only of that field of the record. As long as the recovery manager knows what the operation type is of each of the records in the log, it will know what to do in order to undo or redo that record. So if it says I'm an insert record, it knows that the redo operation is insert the record onto the page, and the undo operation is delete it from the page, which is different than what it would do for a log record that's labeled as a field update. Okay? But one of the problems here, though, as soon as I do that, is that restart cannot blindly redo. Take insert as an example. We're going to insert a record. All right? Now, we start at the penultimate checkpoint, and we scan forward, and we hit this log record, and it says, insert a record into page 0. Insert this record into page 0. Now, the problem is that record may already be in page 0. Right? Because before the failure, you know, this operation may have, this insert may have happened on this page before the system failed. It was after the penultimate checkpoint, but it was before the system failed. It is possible that that dirty page went out to the stable database before the system failed, right? We don't know which of the updated pages that follow the penultimate checkpoint went out to the stable database. Some of them did, some of them didn't. We don't know, right? So given that the insert operation was applied to this page, we're going to read the page off the disk, and we want to apply the insert provided that the operation has not already been processed. We don't want two copies of this record on the page. We only want one copy. So we have to be able to figure out whether the operation has already been done. In other words, these redo operations in the log are not idempotent. Right? Second application of that word. So if you can't just blindly... See, the nice thing about page operations, page updates, is that they're idempotent. You're just installing the after image. Doesn't matter how many times you do it, you're just installing the after image of the whole page. But record-level updates are not idempotent, especially inserts and deletes and things. It's just because you may end up corrupting the page, doing things twice, which you're not supposed to do. So we have to avoid that. And we will, using LSNs again, after we take a break. When I stopped, I raised this question of... I raised this question of update records that you don't want to blindly apply to to the database because they may already have been incorporated in the database before the failure. And so the way we're going to avoid that is by storing the log records LSN on the page. So now every page in the database has a header. It turns out there's other information you want there anyway, but it will have a header. And on the page is the log sequence number, the LSN, of the last update that was applied to that page. So when you read a page out of the stable database into cache, and you fetch it, you know exactly what the last log record was that was applied to that page. So any log record with a smaller log sequence number should not be applied again. And every log record with a larger log sequence number should be applied to that page because it hasn't been done yet. Right? Very simple bookkeeping. Yes?
Will you talk at some point about what to do with that when your LSN wraps?
The question is what to do when the LSN wraps?
That seems not trivial. Or you either do something very expensive or do something very tricky.
You just make sure it never happens.
Use a big number and call
well, it you know, I actually don't know what's... I mean, we can all start to speculate. I actually... It's a good question. I actually don't know what's... Okay. Does anybody happen to know what SQL Server does? I don't know offhand. You know, I can... You know, one possibility, of course, is just to make them so big that they're just... It's just impossible, basically. I don't know whether that's feasible or not. I'd have to start working out some...
Then you're wasting a lot on your page header.
Well, I don't know how big it really has to be in order to have that property. But yes, it will cost you space. You know, it's going to be a time-space trade-off. The alternative is that when it wraps, maybe you have an extra bit, and as soon as it wraps, you start running a background process that goes through and starts cleaning up those headers to reset LSNs. But it seems a little dangerous. I don't know.
Maybe you have to go offline.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll see if I can find out.
Sure.
I'm sort of curious myself. Some of the people you work with might be people I end up...
I suppose I could just check.
Yes. I was going to say, you may be a better source of the answer to this than I am. But... Okay, so therefore, so we're now during this redo pass. We start at the penultimate checkpoint and we start applying update records, redoing them. For each update record, we fetch the page from the stable database into cache. It might already be there, but we fetch it. If the LSN on the page is less than the LSN of the update, then we apply the update, which includes putting the LSN on the page. If the LSN on the page is greater than or equal to the update, might be equal to, right? That would just say that this was the last update that was applied to the page before it was flushed. If the LSN on the page is greater than or equal to the update, then we do not apply the update. Now, undo. All right, so we hit an abort, and the abort says we have to go back and start undoing updates. So let's suppose that we have this update record, and we've been asked to undo it because the transaction aborted. We're following the usual back pointers back through. And so we undo it. Now the question is, given that you undo this update record, what LSN do you put on the page, given that you undo the update record? What are the options? Well, you've got a couple, there's some problems here, right? So suppose there were two transactions that updated different records on the page. All right, and let's say let's say the write operation for transaction 2 comes later than the write operation for transaction 1 in the log, but they both update records on the same page. The second transaction commits, and the first one aborts. So right now, at the time that the second transaction commits, the LSN on the page is the LSN of W2 of Y, because that was the last update that was applied to the page. And now we undo W1 of X. Well, we can't put... Now, you might be tempted to say, well, given that we're undoing W1 of X, we should put on the page the LSN of whatever the transaction was that updated the page before W1 of X. Now, if we were associating LSNs with records rather than pages, that would be okay. But with pages, it doesn't work, because if you put the LSN of the update that preceded W1 of X, like, say, W0 which preceded it, then that LSN is saying that this page has not been updated after that old LSN. Right? So if you store LSN0 on the page, that says that W1 of X has not been applied to the page, and W2 of Y has not been applied to the page. Right? But that's not true. W2 of Y has been applied to the page. So you can't use that LSN. What you kind of want to do is use the LSN of the abort. Right? Because this page, the state of the page, after you undo W1 of X, the state of the page is consistent with this abort records in this abort record in the log, right? That the state of the page is exactly the state it should have as of this abort record in the log. The problem is that the abort record corresponds to undoing many updates. And remember, you have to latch pages while you're doing updates. So if you want to undo an update to a page and install the before image of a record, you have to latch the page while you're doing it. And if you latch the page and release it, you're thereby giving permission for another update to update that page. Well, but you're going to have to do this for many pages. You're going to have to undo the updates for all of the pages that the transaction updated. So you're going to have to latch all of those pages. And if you latch and unlatch them independently, you run the risk of update records showing up later and storing the wrong LSN on the page, right? So some of them may update it before, some of them may update it. You got a problem. So you don't really want to have to latch all the pages. You could try to set page locks on all of them, but we're trying to avoid that. We're doing record level locking. So it's a mess. It's at this point, without doing something special, it does seem like we have a real problem in putting an LSN on these pages.
So you're saying when we unlatch, if somebody else comes and updates it, you're saying that might put in an earlier LSN than the one that we wanted to put? I mean, what is the problem? I mean, updates.
Okay, so the problem is that the aborting transaction has updated page 1.
Right.
All right. Having trouble explaining this. So if you put the abort record, if the abort record's LSN is what's on the page, then the question is, what about another update of a different record on the same page that happens close to this in time? All right. Thank you. clearly, you know, if it comes, if the log record comes later, then you would expect that log record's LSN to be on the page. If the log record comes earlier, then you would expect the abort record's LSN to be on that page.
Right.
Now, looking at just one record, it's easy, right? But the problem is this abort record represents an update to many pages. And it's all, but there's only one abort record that's going in the log. So it's sort of like you have to prevent any, at the time you start undoing the updates to all of this transaction's pages, you've got to get kind of like a temporary lock on the pages of all of them, because otherwise you may end up plant, because you have to, before you start this process, you have to know what the LSN of the abort record is. So you decide what the LSN of the abort record is, and now an update is applied to page one, and now the abort finally gets around to undoing the update to page one and wanting to apply the LSN of the abort record to that page. And now the page has just moved back in time, which is incorrect.
But it wouldn't, right? Because it would see that the LSN is already higher than the one that it's trying to put in, so why would it do the update?
That might work. That might work. But at this point, you know, you're getting in, and you're getting into complex reasoning, and hopefully you're already getting a sense that this is, so how shall I put it? This is the recovery algorithm. Right? You have to be very sure it's the right thing. This is like the last hope of getting the database back into shape. Maybe you can reason your way through that, and maybe it works. But it's the way people have settled on is that you really want each update in the log to correspond to an update to a single page, so that you can really understand the state of the log versus the state of every page in the database independently of every other one. As soon as you start, and this comes up in other cases, I mean, if you know how B-trees work, B-trees page splits are a pain, because they also have this property that what corresponds to a single user operation is actually causing several pages to be updated. And you have to somehow, and they can go out to disk in different orders, and so you somehow have to make it all look like one update. And that's sort of what's going on here. All right, so rather than try to, there may be a good way to do it, and we should think it through, but rather than doing that, let me tell you how it's done. So I just went through the abort business. What's actually done in most cases is that you log the undo operation. So rather than using the abort records LSN, you actually, it's like having multiple abort records. It's like you put in a log record for the undo of every update being undone independently. So now the undo record has an LSN, and that LSN is just like an update record. It's an update in the log. It just so happens the update says, I undid that update. That's what this update says. But it has an LSN, and we can put that LSN on the page just like any other update record. And so now, if the transaction is undoing updates to many different pages, its undo records for all those pages can be spread out in the log, however long it takes to get all of them undone. It doesn't matter. Each one will have a separate LSN, which represents the correct operation that was done to that individual page, one and only one page. Okay. So this preserves the invariant now that the LSN on each page describes exactly the state of the page relative to the log. Notice that if you look at the log records for any aborted transaction, it's going to be do operation 1, do operation 2, do operation 3, undo operation 3, undo operation 2, undo operation 1, abort record. Right? It's going to be a palindrome, you know, like kayak is a palindrome. Words that, you know, look the same in both directions. That's essentially what this is going to be like. It's going to be a sequence of updates followed by a sequence of undos in exactly the reverse order. Right? So take it, the simple case is you perform one update, the transaction aborts, you perform one undo, and then you write the abort record. Or you perform the first update for the transaction and log it, you perform the second update for the transaction and log it, deadlock, you have to abort. And you just start from the end. So, you know, you just do what you abort just like normal. You just follow the back pointer. So the first thing you do is you undo the second update and you log the undo. And then you undo the first update and you log the undo. Right? So however many there are. So it's do, 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 undo, 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 undo in the reverse order. Yeah.
Do you really need to log the undos in the stable storage, or do you just need their LSNs? Because it seems like you just maybe increment the LSN, just grab the number, but not actually deal with trying to, you know, write the undo to disk. Like, is there a secondary reason?
What do you mean by writing the undo record to the stable log?
To the log, yeah.
Yeah, you have to write the undo records to the stable log because these pages may be flushed at any moment during recovery. And so at the time they're flushed, I mean, it's got a real LSN out there. And remember, the restart algorithm has to be restartable. And so you want, you know, you could be in the middle. So you may be running. So here's the situation. You're running restart. You know, you're redoing and undoing and putting LSNs on pages. And halfway through the process, the system crashes again. Not an unlikely event. I mean, it crashed the last time for a reason. Maybe it's going to repeat. So it crashes again. Now you go back and you rerun the algorithm, but now the state of the database is different because some of the pages that were updated during the first execution of restart are now in the database. And so, again, you need to make sure the state of the database is consistent with the state of the log. This means, for example, that the log ahead, the write ahead log protocol also has to be obeyed here. You've got to make sure that you never, the database never gets ahead of the log, basically.
So what are the content of undo operation?
Well, the content of the undo operation is very short. It just says undo the log record described by LSN 247. And that's all that's really needed, because the log record for LSN 247 has whatever before and after image information that was needed. So usually that's all that you really need in the undo record. All right, so let's run restart again. We start at the penultimate checkpoint record, and we redo all updates and undos all the way to the end. Just like before. And when we're done, any transaction that's still active that did not previously commit or abort, we then abort. And during the abort, we write undo records. So abort is actually, restart is actually adding stuff to the log. It's adding undo records to the log for these transactions. That's a first. Up until now, we just performed the undos without actually having to write anything to the log except maybe an abort record. So let's see here.
Do we undo undos? Or do we just
think? Yeah, that's what I'm going to show you.
Okay.
That's exactly what's going to happen. So let's say we have switch colors. So we have R1 of X I'm sorry, I don't want reads. Just, we have W1 of X. W1 of Y. X and Y are on different pages. And now the transaction has to abort for some reason. It deadlocks. And so we undo W1 of Y, you know, because we always do it from the end back toward the beginning. So we undo W1 of Y, and now the system crashes. So we recover, and we start from the beginning of the log during... So now I have to restart. And so restart starts from the penultimate checkpoint and goes through and does a redo. So it does a redo of W1 of X. It does a redo of W2 of Y. None of this is in the log. This is just what it's doing. And then it does a redo of update W1, undo of W1 of Y. It redoes the undo. All right? You with me? And it goes to the that's the end of the log. There is nothing left. And so it notices at the completion of this redo phase that transaction one is still active. And so now it has to undo all of transaction one's operations. And so what it does is it does an undo of the undo of W1 of Y. And then having performed that damage, it now does an undo of W1 of Y again. And then it does the undo of W1 of X. And then it can write the abort record.
Well, the first one's an undo of the redo of the undo, right?
No, this is... Well, yeah, if you want. I mean, these are not... This is not in the log. This is what it did. This is what restart did. But it's not in the log.
Okay.
This is the log up here. And then this is the continuation of the log.
So at the end of all this, I mean, this is something that could grow, get very expensive, and et cetera, et cetera. After you complete a restart, are you going to set new checkpoints so that you know you don't have to do it again?
Yes, it's common practice at the completion of redo, at the completion of restart, it's common practice to take a checkpoint.
Wouldn't you actually have to do two checkpoints?
Well, it depends on how. That's not going to be good for availability. Remember that. So if you take two checkpoints, then you're actually forcing the cache to be flushed, the dirty cache to be flushed, before you run any transactions, which is not necessary. I mean, it is. I mean, it probably will make you feel better because you'll know that the database is completely consistent with the log. You have this warm feeling that everything is copacetic, you know, after that second checkpoint record got written. But actually, there's no real reason to do it. You know, you basically.
Isn't it true that even writing the first checkpoint is work? Because all the undos and stuff that we did during recovery are in the cache.
Yeah, so in effect what's happened is you can't write that next checkpoint record until everything that's dirty in cache has been flushed. Because the next checkpoint record that you write is an indication that everything that preceded the last checkpoint is, see, you kind of do want to perform two checkpoints in a way, although the first of them is kind of doesn't have the usual interpretation. But you clearly, I mean, you've done a lot of work here in sort of getting the cache to be consistent, so you really do want to get back to to a consistent, get the log back to be in a consistent state relative to the cache and the database, persistent database. Let's see here. Where was I? Right. So restart. As I said, restart now is processing commit and abort in the same way. It's just redoing. And notice that abort is indistinguishable from an abort record is indistinguishable from a commit record. Because now, when you hit an abort record, there's nothing to undo. If you're scanning the log forward and you hit an abort record, all the abort record is telling you is that all the undo records are there. And you've just redone them all. So when you hit the abort record, you can just wipe the transaction out from your transaction descriptors in memory. You know that that transaction is complete. There's no difference between a commit record and abort record insofar as restart is concerned. Okay, so there are a couple of tricky issues here. One is that multi-page updates are a pain because if they're dependent on each other. I mean, so I don't want to get into. I think I actually have a slide on this, Let me not get into the details, but let me just give you a feeling for what the issue is. That suppose you had an operation where you want to split a page by copying half of the page onto a fresh page. Now, you got to worry about what order these pages go out, because you're going to treat them as independent updates. You might not be happy about taking half of that page and logging it. That's a lot of stuff to log. I mean, we went through all this trouble to keep the log short, and now we're going to log half of the page in order to be able to ensure that we can undo and redo. Basically, the problem is that the new page that has the half of the records that are being moved and the old page, whose half of the records are supposed to be wiped out, they can go out to disk in either order. So you have to treat them as two independent operations. But the annoying thing is that together the two pages have all the before image and after image that you need. And yet the only way to handle it might be to basically log the entire before image of the page to be split plus the after image of the page to be written with the half of the data that's actually going to go there. So you end up having to log two full pages worth of information in order to be able to send these two pages out in either order. Unless you can control the order, if you can make sure that the new page that has the fresh page that's getting the half of the records from the old page, if you can be sure that one goes out first to the stable database, then you won't have to do as much logging. Because if you get caught in a failure after that page has been written out and before the other one is written out, at least you still have everything you need in order to get the database back into the right state, assuming you've written a log record that explains the state of the world, so that you understand where you're going to have to look for the data in order to get these two pages to be mutually consistent. All right, so, like I said, the details are not important, but you can see why this might be an issue. Another issue is that you're writing log records during restart because you're undoing the updates of active transactions. And that means that each time the system crashes, if it crashes before it completes a checkpoint, the log is going to keep growing, and therefore it's going to take a little longer to run restart the next time. Not a huge issue, but maybe if you were in an environment where very unreliable power, very frequent failures, this might be a consideration. But there is a way around it, which is that you don't have to allow the undo of undo records. What you can do is splice them out. So So here's the example. Suppose time. This is a log you're looking at, and you know, time is moving in this direction as usual. So first, the transaction does operation A, then it does operation B, it does update C, and now the transaction starts aborting. And so it does an undo of C. The undo record of C, instead of pointing to the previous record of the same transaction, which is what you would expect, instead it splices out the operation that's being undone, and it points to the previous operation of the transaction. So what that means is, if the system were to fail at this point, then instead of undoing this, you would just notice, oh, this is an undo record, and it's pointing back to this guy, so the next thing I'm supposed to do is undo B. Because this record is both an undo record with this optimization that's telling you, don't undo me. Instead, start undoing with the record that I'm pointing to. And so these two operations do not get processed. They don't get undone again at recovery time. You just go straight to that guy. And then the next one does the same thing. So if there were no failure at this point, if instead, after undoing C, you got to undo B, so now B is pointing back all the way to A over here. So if the failure happened here, then at recovery time, when you're at recovery time, you do the redo scan, you know, so you scan all the way to the end, and then if you have to undo this transaction, what you do is you start with its last operation, and the last operation says, I'm an undo operation, and the next operation to be undone is the one I'm pointing to, which is this guy. And so all you have to do is do an undo of A. And so you're not extending you are extending the log, but what you're not doing is you're not undoing undos. Because it's the undoing of undos that really is the annoying thing. And if that's what, because it keeps making these transactions longer and longer and longer each time you recover. So by splicing it out, you avoid that problem.
So who undid C? Undo C, undid C, and then...
Sorry?
Okay. When did C get undone?
Because C was undone because the transaction started aborting somewhere around here. It deadlocked, was picked as a victim, and now it has to abort. You don't see that in the log. You could have a start abort record and an end abort record if you wanted, but the start abort record isn't needed because it's not giving you any additional information that helps the recovery algorithms. There's no point in logging it. The fact that there's an undo record is explanation enough. Okay. All right, so here's just the summary now of the algorithm before I do one more optimization, which is you start at the penultimate checkpoint, you scan forward, maintaining a list of active transactions, which is initialized to whatever's in the penultimate checkpoint record. You redo operations during the forward scan. You repeat history. That's the whole game. You repeat history, but for every operation, you look at the page to see whether that operation was actually performed before the failure by doing this LSN comparison. You only redo it if it was not previously done before the failure. And then when you're all done, you abort any transactions that were active at the time of failure and log undos for them as appropriate. Okay? So this is a very famous algorithm. There are many recovery algorithms around, but this one was actually developed over a period of years by lots of different people, but C. Mohan from is a researcher at IBM took it on himself to spend several years of his life figuring this all out and sort of looking at old previous versions of algorithms like this that had been done at IBM and came up with this particular algorithm, the exact one that I'm describing to you now, for which he's won all kinds of awards. It's really a great algorithm. It's called ARIES. It's actually an acronym. I don't remember what it stands for, but it does have a few more twists. And let me describe a couple of them. So remember that while you're running recovery, the system is down. So you want recovery to run as fast as possible. And anything you can do to reduce the amount of I.O. is going to speed up recovery a lot. There's nothing you can do about the log. We know we have to start the log scan with the penultimate checkpoint. But it's the random accesses, retrieving pages from the database, is what's really going to kill us at recovery time. So what can we do to reduce that? And one possibility is that every time we flush a page to the disk, after we get an acknowledgement that the page has been flushed, we could write a log record that indicates that the page has been flushed. And we write that log record before the cache manager releases the latch that it was holding on the page while the flush was in progress. So that flush record now is like checkpointing a single page. All right. So during the redo scan of the log, before you start applying updates, what you could do is you can start at the penultimate checkpoint and scan forward and build a page table that has a list of the oldest or smallest LSN for each page that has to be redone. Right. So let's assume we don't know anything. So we start at the penultimate checkpoint and we hit an update record. As far as we know, this update record has to be redone. So we put page 1 onto the list of dirty pages with the LSN of this update. Right? But a little later during the redo scan, we hit a flush record for page 1. And we say, great! We go back to this dirty page table and we cross it off. In fact, what we could do is just put in the address of this flush record to say we don't need to redo any updates for this page that come before the LSN of the flush record. Because we, in effect, checkpointed that one page when we wrote that flush record out. So we only have to redo updates to that page that come after the flush record. So it's as if for every page in the database there's a different checkpoint record, which is the flush record for that page in the log. And so we have to bookkeep that during this first pass, this analysis pass of the redo scan, so we know what the checkpoint threshold is for every page that's been updated. Right? So flush says delete the page from the dirty page table. Write says add it to the page table if it isn't there. And if you really want to be clever, as long as you're doing all of this, include the dirty page table in checkpoint records. And now the last checkpoint record is meaningful. So you only have to do the analysis pass starting at the last checkpoint record. Right? Because the last checkpoint record has already got a list of all the pages and what the oldest page was that might need to be redone. And now, just starting from that point, you can so now the analysis pass, instead of starting at this penultimate checkpoint, it starts at the last checkpoint, initializes the dirty page table with the contents in the checkpoint record, and does a forward scan to complete the construction of the dirty page table. Because after all, you may see a flush of some page there that was apparently dirty according to the dirty page table in the last checkpoint record. But in fact, none of the previous updates have to be redone because it was flushed later. So that's why you want to complete the analysis after the last checkpoint. After you've done that and you've got the dirty page table, now you play the same game you did before. You start at the penultimate checkpoint, and for each update record, you do the update. You know, but before you read the page from the disk, in order to determine whether the update needs to be redone, you first look at the dirty page table, because the dirty page table may say that the oldest update to this page that needs to be redone comes after you. Or it might not even be in the dirty page table, which means there are no updates to that page that have to be redone. Because we know the last operation in the log on that page was a flush record, and there were no updates after that. So there's nothing to redo. So it's delicate bookkeeping, but with that modest amount of bookkeeping, you can significant, and given the fact that you're basically writing pages out to the disk all the time, you can significantly reduce the amount of I/O required for restart, which means restart will run faster, which means the system will be down for a shorter time, which means the system will be more available. And you got to go back to that, you know, how many nines are you after, you know? If you want to be down for only 5 minutes or 10 minutes a year, it makes a difference whether recovery takes 10 seconds or a minute. Okay. In fact, now that you've got the dirty page table, you know exactly which pages have to be retrieved from disk. So now there's a bunch of other optimizations you can do. First of all, you can actually sort the I.O. You can actually do some disk head scheduling because you know exactly which pages have to be read even before you start the forward scan from the penultimate checkpoint. And so you can start prefetching pages in the order you need them for the log from the log and in order that's good for the disk to minimize head movement, whatever it is you want to optimize in order to get those pages into memory to speed up the recovery process. Okay, and the next slide is on logging B-tree. I didn't talk about B-trees, and I don't really want... I actually did give you like half the story, so that for those of you who know how B-trees work, you probably already recognized this page-splitting problem that I already described. Assignment 4, which I just handed out, is a walkthrough of this algorithm in a very funny way. What I've done is I've given you a log that was produced by some transactions that executed, including some checkpoints. And I've postulated that the system fails at the end of that log. And then I just ask you a zillion questions about that log. You know, what's getting redone? You know, what records are getting written during recovery? What do you know? What can you tell about the behavior of some of these transactions based on looking at these log records? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and then at the end, it's, and then after you do that, that's without the analysis pass, without this final dirty page table business. And then the last few questions are, I add dirty page tables. I say, okay, so now assume that the checkpoint records have these dirty page tables in them, and now let's go back and take another look and see what recovery is going to do in that case. So if you can get through this and get the right answers to this, you will have mastered the this algorithm. It's really a great algorithm and well worth understanding. It's not necessarily, you know, if you don't work in this field, it's not necessarily something you're going to remember 5 years from now. But it will give you the principles of system recovery in whatever environment you come across it. This idea of replaying history in order to roll forward the state of the system to where it was at the moment of failure and then fixing things up So even if the system was in a crappy state at the moment it failed, the first thing is get the system back into the state that it was at the time of failure, and then fix things up from there. And that this logging algorithm is all based on this replay of history to get things back to where they were. It's a way of understanding the state to be able to recover from a failure in a very complex, very kind of randomish environment. There's only a limited amount you can do as a user in this world. You won't really see the behavior of the recovery algorithm very much, except for how long it takes. It's good to understand how it behaves, because there may be things you can do with the way you configure the log, or certain system management parameters, like what the minimum checkpoint frequency is, which are much easier to control if you understand what's going on underneath the covers. You know how these manuals are written. It's sort of like, if you want this to recover faster, checkpoint more frequently, but it's going to be more costly. Well, how much more reliable? How much more costly? What is it really doing? Could I, sort of get some intuition so I understand how to control this thing? Well, if you understand the algorithm, you can kind of get a feel for it and run some tests and understand, just as a function of log length, roughly what recovery, how much time recovery is taking, and so forth. If availability is extremely important, you may end up spreading the database across more disks than are actually needed for ordinary processing. You know, maybe you can give satisfactory response time to transactions, even under peak load, by spreading the database across 3 disks. But it might be that recovery, even at a fast checkpoint interval, is going to have the system be down for too long, and that you might need to spread the database across 4 or 5 disks so that at recovery time you have enough disk bandwidth for restart to be able to do its operations quickly and thereby get the system operational even faster. Oh, here's a trick. I don't think it's not in the slides, but I think it might even be in the book. So during the analysis pass, when you're scanning things forward and you've got this dirty page table, the dirty page table is a list of all the pages that might have to be recovered. Even before you read them from disk, have the recovery system set locks on all of them. Write locks on all of them. That's not going to take very long. Once the recovery system has write locks on all those pages, it can start running ordinary transactions, even before it's redone a single operation. Because all of the pages that are potentially inconsistent are now locked and unavailable. Now, it sounds great, right? Almost too good to be true, because now you can run ordinary transactions in parallel with recovery. And even though the system is not really totally up yet, it has the illusion of being up, because many transactions can actually run. And all you had to do was, you never read the database, all you had to do was process the tail of the log after the last checkpoint in order to rebuild that dirty page table. That was the whole thing. How long can that take? Right? It's a sequential read of a tail of the log. And you've been running checkpoints frequently. This cannot be a very time-consuming operation. All right? Sounds great. What's wrong? Well, what's wrong is there are hot pages. Right? In every system, you know, this is like Zipf's law at work, that there's always a few pages that a very large fraction of transactions want to read and write. And as soon as you start running transactions, some of those transactions are going to appear, and they're going to start running, and they're going to bump into these pages that are locked, because since those pages are hot, they almost surely have been updated and not flushed before the failure. So they're almost surely in the dirty page table, locked. And so some transactions may be able to start running, but probably as soon as you spin up a large enough number of threads with new transactions, you're going to very quickly get into the situation where a large fraction of the active transactions are blocked waiting for the recovery system to finish. So you can start making progress, you'll get some throughput, but you got to be a little bit careful as to whether this is really worthwhile. Plus, those active transactions are slowing down recovery because they're reading from the disk. So it's not clear whether it's a net win. But it is an intriguing possibility. I know one prototype system that went as far as actually logging the locks in the last checkpoint record, and even periodically after that, so that at recovery time it didn't even have to experience the overhead of going through the lock manager to set all those locks. It could just take those locks and just dump them in batch into the lock table to avoid the path length of, you know, the instruction count of updating the lock table. So, you know, you can take this to extremes. I have no idea whether this is really worthwhile, but it's certainly not crazy. Okay, we're about to switch topics and take a break, so before I do that, are there any questions on ARIES and these optimizations? Yeah, Ivo?
If you have, for example, 5 disks, can you do this approach per disk? So after I finish work with disk one, I make it available for transactions, then disk two, disk three, disk four.
With a single log?
That last optimization you mentioned. You lock everything.
All right, so the idea is that you set all the locks, and now you consciously try to recover one disk at a time?
Yeah.
And the benefit of this is what?
After you finish the first disk, you can make it available for the transactions.
Well, you can make... Yeah, but what's the benefit of making a particular disk available for transactions?
The transactions won't slow down the recovery process in that disk.
Ah. So if you could figure out which transactions were accessing which disk... Then recovery.
Yeah.
Then recovering the disk quickly would be a good thing, because then it would not the active transactions would not interfere with recovery of that disk. I've never seen it done. It sounds like it would be hard to arrange. Yeah.
Have you started some transactions going on, but you're still recovering? I don't know. I have a hard time understanding what will happen to the logged file, right? Because we are trying to recover at the same time as new stuff is coming into it. So
you're worried about what recovery is doing while new stuff is coming in with respect to the log. The only thing that's going to happen to the log during recovery is we're going to abort transactions that were active at the time of failure. And so if new transactions come in and write log records, well, that's fine. They're not updating any of the pages that we've got page level locks on these pages. This is not record level lock.
He's saying that normally the end of the log is important in recovery.
Yeah.
So he's saying if the log is getting extended, how do I know when I reached the end of the log that was the end of the log at the time I started recovery?
Well, but that's.
Or keep track.
I'm not sure it matters. I mean, just the main thing is that when restart is finished, it's going to run a checkpoint. And, you know, if some other transaction is committed in the meanwhile, well, they're going to get the benefit of the checkpoint too. And there's no real harm in that. They were updating other pages anyway. So it's just they just get a free ride. Okay, why don't we stop, take another break, and then I'll... So, first is that somebody in the audience figured out what the LSN situation is. LSNs They never get reused. Is the simple story. It's a long number, and in particular, it has a 32-bit prefix, which is the number of times the log has wrapped. Now, I don't know. You could work it out, but you know, wrapping a log means going through the entire disk. So even just you just take a sequential scan of a disk, and it's measured in hours. So let's say that you can. I mean, it's, so let's say you can wrap a disk in 10 times a day, just in round numbers. It's probably too much, but it isn't going to be any more than that. So if it's 32 bits, you can wrap the log 4 billion times before you run out of LSNs. And you can only wrap it 10 times per day. So that means you can wrap it 400. You can wrap it 400 million days before you run out of. You run out of LSNs. There are not too many disks that are likely to last that long, so I think you're pretty safe. Okay. So I want to say, part of this assignment this week is to read Chapter 7 on database recovery. The first, I think, 6 or 7 pages of that chapter I did not cover. And I might not, I'm not sure, but it's basically on system recovery. It's to kind of get you from the point of we've got a computer system that's unreliable to the point where the thing that really matters here is recovering the database. And it just goes through the line of argument on how to get there. There's no complicated algorithms to speak of, but it kind of walks you through the line of reasoning. And then the rest of the chapter is on all this recovery stuff we've talked about. The one thing that is unfortunately missing at this point, just because I have not gotten around to writing it, is the description of the dirty page table and the analysis path. That last two slides of ARIES, where it talks about how to construct the dirty page table, store it in the checkpoint record, and reuse it at recovery time, that's not in the book. Everything else up to that point is. If you have questions, send mail. But I think the slides are pretty detailed, so hopefully that's enough. So the next couple pages here, the next couple slides, is on a part of the system I never know where to cover because it's sort of a little bit on recovery and a little bit on system modeling. It's a little bit on concurrency control. So with that, let me just say this next couple slides doesn't naturally follow from what preceded it. But it is important, and it's on shared disks. So one of the things that comes up in systems is that, and this started actually back in the, I guess it was in the 1980s with VAX clusters, is that you build systems with multiple processors on a bus sharing disk drives. And if you do that, and this is not the only scenario, I mean, but you know, now with storage area networks, it's actually a fairly common thing where you have processors all hooked up to some very high bandwidth storage channel and able to access multiple disks. Now, they typically don't actually access the disk at the same time, but from the hardware's point of view, it actually is possible. And there are data management scenarios where this is permitted. In fact, back in the 80s, this was the way database systems were built. That is to say, the database system was not a server process that you communicated with by sending messages. Not at all. The database system ran as a runtime library inside the application. And so every application program was running the database system, and they were all going at this shared disk. And since they each had a separate process, they each had a private cache. And so now you run into this problem of how do they make sure that they maintain cache consistency. All right, so you've got two processes here in this picture, A and B. They're both accessing page P. Obviously, you only want to have one process. The unit of data being moved in and out of the process is a page, so you only can have one process able to write a page at a time. So you've got to have some way for these two processes to synchronize with respect to one another. And the way it's done is with generally is with some kind of a global lock manager. So you have a global lock manager. And the global lock, so if when a process wants to read a page into its cache, it first it sets a lock on the page with the global lock manager saying, I have a copy of the page in the cache. So it's like a read lock, if you will. And then the other page says, well, I have a copy of the page in the cache, so it sets a read lock. That's fine. If a process wants to write the page, it has to go get a write lock on the page from the global lock manager. And at that time, it may have to reread the page from disk because it's possible that the page has been updated since the last time it read it. Yes?
But if it's not on disk yet, what if it's still in the process's cache?
It could be in another process's cache having been updated. Right, so we'll get to that. But just sort of pointing out that even if the page is in the process's cache at the time it sets the write lock, that doesn't mean that it can necessarily start writing, because it has to make sure it's updating the last version of the page. All right, so when a process sets a lock, it actually tells the lock manager the version number of its cached page. This could be an LSN, but just think of it as a version number. And each time an update is performed, that version number is increased. So in the old days, when this kind of thing was first created, it was there were no LSNs and logs. It was just keeping the pages consistent. And so it really was a version number, some small integer. When a process is done updating a page, it flushes the page to disk, increments the version number in the lock at that time. That way, the next process that tries to set a lock on the page is going to get back the version number of that page in the lock and can thereby determine whether the copy of the page it has in cache, if it has a copy in cache, is still up to date. And if it isn't, then it can read it off. Well, it depends on whether it's cache-to-cache transfers or read it off the disk. But typically, what's done is updated pages are bounced off the disk. So the sequence, it's really a lot like this latching business from cache to the database. That if you want to update the page, you set a lock on the page, you update the page in your cache. At some point later, you're going to flush this page and release the lock, thereby allowing other processors to read the page. But before you release the lock, you want to flush the page to disk so that when you release the lock to the lock manager, the next process that reads the page, when it reads the lock, and if it determines that it needs to actually fetch the page, if it fetches it from disk, it will get the latest version of the page. Now, the alternative is what's actually done in processor caches, which is that you use a Snoopy cache, where you can actually do cache-to-cache transfers rather than having to flush it through all the way back into main memory. Because generally, the communication bandwidth between processes is much better than bouncing off the disk. Really nasty is process A and B could even be on the same machine. And then that's really annoying that you have to bounce the data off the disk in order to get it to process B. At least if they're on the same machine, you would like to be able to have them share some pooled cache on the same machine. Now, why am I doing this in the recovery section? Well, how are you going to do a log manager in this world? Because the way you want the log manager to work is that each machine that's accessing this shared disk, you would expect it to have its own log. But that's not really going to work out very well because the database is this shared entity, and therefore the log is a shared entity. So the way you're going to have to ultimately do this, presumably, is to have a log manager somewhere. But you can't possibly afford sending log records to this log manager every time there's an update. So what you're going to have to do is arrange things so that you can log locally as often as for as long as possible based on stuff in the cache, and then based on when you have to push updates from your cache to the database, that's when you have to do this write-ahead log protocol where you kind of ship the tail of the log you've been accumulating to the log manager, which thereby enables you to flush cache, or at least flush part of your cache, and then move forward, so that the amount of communication between each processor and the shared log manager can be minimized. Right. And there are systems that do this. IBM has a data sharing system. Oracle has a data sharing system. They actually, I think they had two of them. I think one of them they inherited from Digital when they picked up Digital's database system, RDB. So there are systems out there that do it. These days, you know, we're so into shared nothing machines that with disks being private to each machine, there's not much activity in the way of developing this kind of technology in the future. But there is a call for it. It's maybe a niche market, but there is definitely a commercial interest in this kind of technology. Okay, so that was just an aside. Let me now wrap up the chapter by talking about media failures, and I think I have just about enough time here to get through this. So this whole discussion last on Monday and today was about what to do when main memory is lost, because the operating system failed or the data manager failed. And we assumed that the disk was infinitely reliable. And most of you have been in this business long enough to have seen disks fail, and unrecoverably. And so, you know, you might well ask, what are you going to do about that? So most disks have a mean time between failures of somewhere in the 10 to 100 year range. There's actually some recent work by Catherine Venning and then Microsoft Research out of San Francisco that you can get if you're interested. She's published a technical report on with Jim Gray on the behavior of disks, real numbers. And actually, these things are pretty reliable, but they do fail. And it's not uncommon to have dozens of disks hooked up to one of these transaction processing systems, you know, bigger ones, certainly thousands of disks. So you're going to be experiencing disk failures all the time. So one way, obvious, simple way of improving the reliability of the disk, that is, improving the mean time between failures of the disk, is to have each disk be shadowed using two disks. So all writes go to both disks, reads get processed from either disk. So it's one logical disk is actually two disks. This is done all the time in transaction processing. You probably want, if not at the hardware level, then maybe at the software level if you need to, you don't want writes to go to both disks simultaneously. You want there to be a handshake in between, because if there's a physical failure, like an earthquake, you don't want writes to be going to the same position on the same disks at exactly the same moment. You'd like there to be a bit of a delay. I mean, it can be a pretty small fraction of a second, but you do want there to be a bit of a delay, because you want these things to have independent failure modes. Now, occasionally, one of the two disks is going to fail for each of these shadowed pairs. And the natural thing to do then is to cut in another disk to pick up the load, right? You don't want to be running with just one disk. So, you know, the obvious thing to do then is to shut down the system, you know, bring in this disk, copy the old disk to the new disk, and then bring everything up again. But, of course, that's just totally preposterous, because the whole reason to do this was not to have to suffer downtime due to a failed disk. I mean, if you were going to do that, you could just do checkpoint restart. You know, you didn't need to go through the shadowing stuff. So you've got to be able to bring up a new shadow while the system is running. And, you know, if you start thinking about it, it's actually not obvious how to do it, because you're servicing reads and writes against the old disk while you're copying data to the new disk. And it seems like the new disk is simply never going to catch up. But in fact, once you see the algorithm, it's just a couple lines here. It's pretty trivial. What you do is you start copying data from one end of the old disk, just starting from the beginning, let's say track by track or cylinder by cylinder. You copy from the old disk to the new disk. And you keep track. You remember what that track, what that cylinder number is that you're copying. And while you're doing the copy, you don't process any writes against that unit, like that track or that cylinder, whatever it is. So there's going to be some transaction delay while you're doing the copy. But you can process other transactions. You can process other reads and writes. If you process a write operation that comes before the track that you're copying, then that means it's on both disks. So you write to both disks. If you update a track that's after the track that's currently being copied, you only have to write to the old disk. The new disk could care less because it hasn't been refreshed yet with the latest data. So basically, you just have this this threshold number that's just kind of moving across the old disk, that's telling you how much of the disk is shadowed and how much of it isn't, so that you can run normal operation in parallel with bringing the new disk up. Now it's going to slow down bringing the new disk up because basically because of this head movement going on, it's going to take a while. This is not, you're not going to do it at disk transfer speed. It might take a day to get the new disk up and running. But based on the failure rate of disks, the chances of a second failure of another disk independent of the first disk within a day, when the mean time between failure of a disk is 3 years or 5 years or whatever it is regarded as small enough to be acceptable. But it's not zero. I mean, if you have enough disks, you will see a double point failure. You will get a second failure of the second disk before you get a chance to recover the first one. If you have thousands of disks, it can happen. So another approach that's been around since the late 80s is RAID, which stands for Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disks. Sometimes people say independent disks, but when it was first proposed, it was based on the fact that PCs were creating a market for low-cost disks, which were extremely unreliable, but were very cheap. And so the thought was, if you could make them reliable by putting them into an array with a sufficient redundancy, then you would get the benefit of their low cost without the problem, the liability of their poor reliability. So the way you do it is that you set up the set of disks as one big disk. And it's striped. Now, how shall I explain striping? Well, a stripe, so the first block of this, so these rectangles represent, how did I do this? Oh, they're already set up. I'm getting tired. I should read my own slides. It's already set up this way. So these are meant to be blocks of the disk. So this is a block on disk 1, this is a block on disk 2, this is the first block on disk 3, etc. Okay? So if there are M blocks, together these M blocks are the first M times 8K bytes of the disk. It's a logical disk. Right? And then the next M blocks on these disks represent the second unit of storage, the second stripe. Now, in order to make this reliable enough, you set aside several of the disks to hold error detecting or even error correcting code for the first M blocks. So if you want to read the first logical block of the RAID, what you do is you read the first block of all the disks and you use the error correcting codes or error detecting codes on these extra blocks to determine whether the first M blocks are okay. Now, if it's an error correcting code, that means you can actually suffer a block failure and still be able to rebuild the block because you've got enough redundant bits on the other blocks to be able to reconstruct. You know how error correcting codes work. Basically, it's enough I'm not going to try to explain error-correcting codes. But it can be done with a relatively small number of extra disks. So maybe if you've got 8 disks, if you set aside 2 or 3 of them for the 3 of them, I guess, for an error-correcting code, then you would get 5 disks worth of data, 3 disks worth of error-correcting code, and you could suffer a single disk failure. Any disk could fail without losing data. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, there are RAID systems that are not... This is what's called RAID 5. There's a whole sequence of RAID systems, which RAID 1, RAID 2, RAID 3, which have increasing levels of redundancy in order to get this kind of behavior. But this is a very common way to do it. It's an expensive way to do it. And I've seen some systems where reliability is important, where they do shadowed RAID 5. Not uncommon, because now you can really handle the double point failure. But you know, you pay for it, especially compared to commodity disk prices. All right, so where do you use this? Well, obviously, the more reliable the disks, the better. But at least you should use shadowing for the log, because if the algorithm allows undo, then if you lose the log, there are going to be updates that you've allowed to go to the database that have to be undone, and you no longer have the before image. So it's a single point failure. If you lose the log, the database is inconsistent and you can't fix it because you've lost the undo information. Or if it's a redo algorithm, you have the same problem with after images. You've committed the transaction, you've told the user, the transactions have already executed that read the results of the previously updated data, and they've done updates, and they're in the log too. But none of this stuff has been flushed to the stable database yet, because we're using ARIES. We're using this undo-redo logging algorithm. Now we've lost the log. So we've lost a whole chain of dependent updates that have been committed. You know, checks have been written, money has been moved between banks, and there's nothing in the database that records that fact. Not a good thing. So, at the very least, you want to shadow the log. You don't necessarily have to shadow the database, because we're going to archive the database, and the archived database plus the log will be enough to be able to recover the database. It's slow, it's going to take a while, but we do have, the log is the database, right? Because it's the log that gets flushed at commit. So it's the log that has the latest state of the world, not the database. In effect, the database is a convenient cache for the log. It is, right? That's why it's funny, but it's true. The database is a convenient cache for the log. And in fact, I've seen databases built where the log is the database. I'm not going to take time to describe it here, but I've seen systems built that way where you read from the log. You know, you have an index, you index into the log. It's just this big sequential thing. That's all there is. And they don't do a cache because they don't need it. So it's not a crazy idea. All right, so what about this archiving business? Well, an archive is a snapshot of the database that is kept for long-term recovery. So if you lose a shadowed disk in the database, you need to reconstruct it. And just like you do checkpoint recovery of a file system, what you would do is you would go to the archive, you would take the latest full backup you took of that disk, you know, you load it onto the new disk, and then you roll forward all the updates that have happened since you took that archive snapshot. That could take a while, but so be it. I mean, that's, you know, this is like the last hope, right? This is not something you expect to have to do very often. Now, the only question is, how do you take an archive snapshot, given that the system is running 24/7? I mean, you can't shut it down. There's no time to shut it down to take an archive snapshot. And unlike a file system backup, consistency is paramount. So file systems, you know, you just take a backup and the backup procedure gets whatever it gets. You know, and if the system crashes and you reload from the last backup plus the incrementals, well, okay. I mean, it may not be exactly the state of the disk at the time of the failure because it depends on what happened afterwards. It's just taking these snapshots at various times. So, but here it's got to be accurate. So, the way it can be, one way to do it, a simple way to do it, is you write a start. This is basically a fuzzy checkpoint. You write a start archive checkpoint, start archive record to the log. You copy the database to the archive medium, and then you write another checkpoint to the log that says that the checkpoint that I started yesterday afternoon is now complete, which means that all updates in the log that preceded the start archive record are now in the archived copy of the database and therefore do not need to be redone. Right? Because that's what this is all about. If you lose a disk, what you're going to do, you're going to take the last archive checkpoint, you're going to load it onto a disk, and then you have to run redo. And you don't want that to take too long. So you want to have as the smallest amount of log possible to be able to roll forward. So it's the same old game. You want to write a checkpoint record to the log so that says this is the only amount that you have to redo. This is standard LSN-based restart. So, what about archiving the log? Well, a pair of shadowed disks for the log might not be good enough, because now you're not only going to have to archive checkpoint the database, you also have to save the log onto an archive. When you wrap the log, you can't just start overwriting. You have to be able to take the log and put it somewhere, because that's going to be part of your archive recovery story. It's the last checkpoint plus the log. And unless you're going to be able to archive the database every couple of hours, which you're not, you're going to have to be able to save that log every time it wraps. So you don't need two disks for the log. You need four disks for the log. Otherwise, the head contention will kill you when you're doing. You can actually get by with three if you think about it. You basically partition the three disks into three logical disks, so that for each logical disk is only on two of the spindles. And then, so there's always a spindle free to be able to dump half a disk's worth of log while the others are filling up. With disks as cheap as they are today, it's probably not even worth talking about. But for years, people went through this to optimize the number of disks that were needed to be able to handle this recovery. To do an incremental archive, what you do is you put it in. Remember, we have a page header on every database page? Well, you have an archive bit in that page header, which indicates that the page was updated since the last time it was archived. So instead of having to dump the entire disk to the archive, you only have to dump the pages that were actually updated since the last archive checkpoint. So you basically do a sequential, so the archiver does a sequential scan of the disk in the database, and then every page that has the archive bit checked, set, it copies that to the archive checkpoint and clears the bit. So presumably many pages in the database do not get updated within one inter-checkpoint interval for archiving. And so it doesn't reduce the amount of reading you have to do to archive, but it does significantly reduce the amount of writing. And you may still want to take a complete checkpoint of the disk periodically, but what this does is it allows you to checkpoint more frequently. And clearly, recovering a page from one of these incrementals is going to be faster than having to reload the whole disk and roll forward. So a common disk problem is a block becomes corrupted. The disk is okay, but when you read that block, it's corrupted. And you don't want the answer to be rebuild the disk. It's only one page. I mean, it happens to be the bank balance of your account, but it's only one page. So what you'd like to do is just reload that the last known good value for that one page and roll it forward. And as you know, if you sort of think about how this the recovery algorithm works, this works fine. You just have to do the forward scan of the log, but you only have to look at records that actually update records that apply to that page, and just ignore everything else. So you actually can recover an individual page, and it will go a whole lot faster than trying to recover the whole disk. So that's another thing that's commonly done. And that actually is a feature to look for in databases as a user, because not every database system can do individual page recovery. But it's a killer if you don't have it, because pages do get corrupted independently. Yeah.
How is using the archive bit different than like noting the LSN at the time you begin the archive and only archiving pages with a greater LSN?
Well, the LSN business is the standard archiving. You're still archiving all pages. You're writing the start archive record. I'm not understanding what you're suggesting, but you're writing the start archive record, then you're dumping the entire database, and then the end archive record. Here, you're doing all of that, but you're observing that you don't really have to do it for all pages. You only have to do it for pages that actually were updated since the last time you went through this process.
Okay. So it would be the same as like the LSN of the last transaction at the end of the last archive or something like that, and then the next time the next archive starts, you go from there.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm awake enough to reason this through, but that sounds right. I hesitate to say yes, because I'm not sure. But it's there are many variations here, just like for Aries. Any other questions? This is it. This is the last slide. Yeah.
Sometimes we do some kind of disaster recovery.
Yeah.
Basically, pushing
two different locations.
Yeah, locations. So they should do something like this. So because. Okay. If you do online.
All right, so disaster recovery is another topic. I would like to get to it. I hope I have some time. There's a little bit about it in the first few pages of Chapter 7. But there are many ways to go about it. And certainly one way is to basically have all this archiving stuff go off-site so that you can rebuild the system somewhere else. But for any system that really needs to be up with high availability, that's generally not how it's done. That generally what you do is you actually replicate the database across a long wire, so that you might have shadowed database or shadowed disks, but more likely shadowed database running in two locations, and updates to the database in one location are piped to the database in the other location and applied in both places, so that if you lose, if there's an earthquake in Redmond, you still have a copy of the database in Denver. You may have lost the last few transactions that didn't quite make it before the failure, that were applied in Redmond and did not quite make it to Denver before the failure. But except for that, the databases are kept very close together. That's usually the way it's done. Another way it can be done is even at the transaction level, where you submit transactions to both systems, and you run the transactions independently at both systems, but you do it in a way where you have enough sequencing control to know that the transactions were executed in the same order in both systems. Now, there are very few applications for which that has to be true, but the stock market happens to be one of them, because for legal reasons, buys and sells have to be run in exactly the timestamp order in which they were submitted, because it affects the price of the equity. And so you can actually do replication, just because the legalities of the way the application works actually means you can replicate at the transaction level that way. So there are many layers in the system at which the replication can happen. But this technique is one. It's kind of the cheapest way of doing it, but it also has the longest recovery time. You've got to get the database over there, you've got to be able to load it onto the disks, got to run the log, roll it all forward. You have nothing, right? This is rebuilding the whole database from scratch. It's going to take a while. So, but it's done. And so for some applications, it's good enough. Okay, we're out of time. Let's stop. Next lecture is a week from today. A reminder that we have another Monday lecture a week from Monday. Not this coming Monday, but the following week, I think, is the other Monday lecture.